From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. We've been off the air for the past 2 weeks, so this is the first Nap Chat of 2022. Hopefully, the new year will bring good news for our country, the Postal Service, and of course, for Naps Chat listeners. So, as Congress inches its way into an election year, in which the partisan makeup of the House and Senate will be in the balance, postal reform legislation, H.R. 3076, is poised for a House floor vote later this month. At this point, the House leadership is awaiting a revised cost estimate of the bill from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. On a related note, it is unlikely that the nominations to the Postal Board of Governors of Daniel Tangerlini or Derek Kahn will be considered by the Senate until the Senate discharges its prospective responsibility on consideration of the postal bill, which is awaiting House action. So, till that time, the Board of Governors is functioning with 8 presidentially nominated governors. Since Governor John Barger is in his so-called holdover year, he serves until Derek Kahn is confirmed. Consequently, there is one vacancy on the board. Another bit of postal news is that on Tuesday, the United States Postal Service asked the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, for a temporary waiver from the administration's vaccine mandate, as applied to large employers. In its letter to OSHA, the Postal Service suggested that the vaccine requirement, or in lieu of a vaccine, weekly negative COVID tests, would impair the agency's ability to deliver the mail because the policy would force the unvaccinated employees to be off the clock. On Friday, January 7th, the Supreme Court will conduct, or has conducted, a hearing on the administration's mandate as it applies nationwide. Now let's greet this week's guest on Naps Chat, Dr. Christopher Shaw. Christopher is a returning guest to Naps Chat. Chris Shaw is a research fellow at the Center for Study of Responsive Law, and he's the author of a number of books and articles exploring the relationship between the American public and governmental institutions, including the United States Postal Service. About a year and a half ago, Chris and I spoke on Naps Chat about his book, Preserving the People's Post Office, Postal Reliance, and the Role of the Postal Service that it played in the 2020 presidential election. During this week's Naps Chat, I would like to talk to Chris about his latest publication, First Class, the United States Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. Thanks for joining me this week on Naps Chat, Chris.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Chris, your first book, Preserving the People's Post Office, was published in 2006. Comparing the 2000 book with the 2021 book, which was just published, has your perspective on the Postal Service changed?
My perspective on the Postal Service remains that it is, first of all, a public service, and also that the American public, who are the people who receive the mail, need to have an adequate voice in its governance and its future. But certainly the context has changed. Back in 2006, a lot of concerns were about electronic diversion, but at the same time, when I was researching that book, the mail volume kept going up. That has changed. With 2006, it peaked and it's been in decline, and we've seen a shift in the agency to where it's spending a lot more of its effort on delivering packages. So I think that what has changed is really the context, and it is a different situation today than it was 15 years ago.
So that's the reason why a new Chris Shaw review of the Postal Service was necessary in 2021?
That's exactly right. That and also the fact that back in 2006, there really was not, frankly, the same public interest in the Postal Service as there is today. The events of 2020 certainly led to a lot of Americans taking a new interest in the subject, and I thought that they deserved to have an up-to-date perspective on those questions.
I recall in 2020, when we spoke last, you were very excited about the public's new interest in the Postal Service as reflected in actions taken by the American public and by Congress during the summer of 2020 to protect democracy and particularly absentee balloting. Do you think that public interest has been maintained over the past year and a half?
I don't think it's at the same level that it was in 2020. That was a pivotal moment when I do think that the public engagement with the issue had important and positive consequences. But there still is a level of interest and an awareness around the issue that I just didn't see before. So I do think that while it's not at that intensity that it was at that time, that interest still remains.
The refrain that's a constant throughout your writings, whether in the form of your books or articles about the Postal Service, is that you constantly state that the Postal Service, quote, belongs to the people, end quote. What basis do you have for that observation? And relatedly, is this simply a statement that all federal agencies belong to the American public, or is something unique about the Postal Service?
I think that all federal agencies do exist to serve one various ways the American public and should be accountable to the American public who they exist to serve. But I think that in the case of the Postal Service, or what was previously the Post Office Department, that is in many respects a unique situation because its entire development was very much shaped by the actions of the public. So, for instance, people wanted to have mail delivered to their house. So in cities. And so that was a service that was provided. There was a major campaign to get rural free delivery. And so RFD was created. And that was really through petitions and letters and lobbying of Congress. Parcel post, the idea that the Post Office Department would deliver packages, that was also a result of popular demands for that service because the existing private companies provided inadequate and often price gouging services. The postal savings system that operated in the 20th century was another result of demands that the public made to extend this service. So the whole shape of the postal system that we know in this country is, and, you know, you can look at even other examples besides the ones I named, very much the product of citizen engagement and really the American people taking ownership of the Postal Service and saying what they think it ought to do and the ways in which it could provide new services that would in various ways improve their lives and be a more meaningful government service in the public life that we all share.
In that light, I know you spoke about it in both your 2006 book and your 2021 book about creating some type of public commission, a Postal Customers Commission, to take sort of ownership and to have a more of a stake in the Postal Service and its operations. Could you flesh that out a little bit with me?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the Postal Service, the way sort of it's administered, is a very good example of how different stakeholders do have a seat. So postal employees through organizations like your own or, you know, the postal unions, they have an opportunity to have a say. The major mailers, they have their place. Management has its place. But I do think that often the residential patron, sort of the average citizen, is not always represented to the same level when decisions are made about postal policies. And so the idea, and this is an idea that Ralph Nader first came up with back in the 1970s, is to have a post office consumer organization. And essentially all that would be involved is delivering postcards a few times a year or a letter a few times a year to residential addresses, offering people the opportunity to pay a membership due and join a post office consumer organization. And then that organization would have a budget and it could hire a staff, and the staff would exist much like these other groups that lobby and seek to influence postal affairs work, where they'd, you know, have economists and researchers and attorneys and all these important figures. And so the idea would to provide the kind of the average American citizen who uses the Postal Service with their representative, with their own organization, to look out for their interests when policies are being made.
In your 2021 book, First Class, you decry the decade-long corporatization of the Postal Service. You suggest that the hiring of the current Postmaster General and the composition of the Board of Governors altered or underscored the transformation of the Postal Service from a service-focused federal agency to a corporate-driven operation. Now, Chris, we've had Postmaster Generals in the past and members of the Board of Governors in the past from the private sector as well as highly placed political operatives. What makes the current postal team different?
I don't know that I would say. I mean, you make a very good point about the fact that oftentimes in history, Postmaster Generals were strictly political operatives, and often they came with business backgrounds. And I think that actually knowing how to navigate Washington, D.C. politically can be helpful for a Postmaster General. And understanding of the way that a large enterprise, such as a business works, can be helpful as well. But I do think that there has been a trend where members of the Board of Governors have often been very much coming from a background in the corporate world and in the business world. And this means that they don't really have the kind of outlook on public service that would be helpful. They don't have experience thinking about a public service. And so that aspect of the Postal Service can then become kind of neglected and forgotten. I think in the case of the current Postmaster General, it was definitely a change from what we've seen in recent decades, because you really have to go back to Anthony Frank was the last one who came from really just a business background, because Postmaster General Runyon had been the TVA. So at least in recent history, that was definitely a shift. But I do think in general that it would be good to have more people with public service backgrounds in occupying these kinds of important positions inside the Postal Service, so that that side of the Postal Service gets adequate representation.
Do you think that the new presidential nominees, some who have been confirmed, some who are pending before the Senate, like, for example, Ron Stroman, who used to work for the Postal Service as the Deputy Postmaster General, used to work on Capitol Hill, used to work for the Government Accountability Office, Amber McReynolds from Colorado, who was vote by mail, and other folks that have been appointed by Joe Biden, as compared to the previous appointees who came out of the financial services industry primarily, do you think that's going to make a difference on postal governance?
I think it definitely could. And the way when you write books, they don't go to press immediately, so there's a bit of a time lag. So I don't get to get into those new nominations. But I think that was definitely a breath of fresh air. And having people with a more diverse set of backgrounds, and also with backgrounds that we don't often see amongst members of the Board of Governors, I think it will bring some new ideas to the table, and probably will get hopefully some novel discussions about these kinds of issues. And so I am hopeful that having a more diverse group on there with a different outlook can help the Postal Service to move forward into the future.
Let's talk about getting policies implemented, particularly with regard to legislation. Late last year, a noted correspondent and former Washington Post editor we both know, Bill McAllister, stated in Naps Chat that removing politics from postal governance is, in fact, a two-edged sword. And he observed that the sharper edge being that an apolitical Postmaster General could restrict access to the Oval Office when the Postal Service really needs something important. Do you agree with that?
I think that is, he raises an important point there, which is that back, if you're to go back before reorganization, when the Postmaster General was a member of the cabinet, that provided a whole other level of access to the president and the White House when it came time to determine policy priorities. And so that is really lacking. I mean, it's much different where the Postmaster General is off in Lenfant Plaza and is supposed to really kind of stay there and not get involved in politics in that way. So I do see certainly his, I think, very astute point about how this can cut both ways.
One of my more favorite stations is the History Channel, and they recently concluded a three-part program entitled The Titans That Built America. In one part of one of the episodes. It recounted the importance in the 1920s of Ford Aviation, a division of Ford, and the importance of that division to the growth of airmail in the United States. In fact, they owned airmail in the 1920s, Ford Aviation. More recently, Pitney Bowes enabled many businesses to expand their mailing capabilities, and FedEx has been both a competitor and a partner in prompt mail delivery. So I want to ask you this question, Chris. At what point does the relationship between the Postal Service and private industry become corrosive to the public interest?
Well, I think that's a tough one to always identify, but I guess in general I would say it's the point where public service begins to suffer, or maybe even the Postal Service itself begins to become undermined by that relationship. And so, I mean, if you were to look at the FedEx deal that's, I think, going on 20 years now to transport mail on the FedEx airplanes, the Postal Service, obviously, it needs to have air transportation, or, well, it needed to. I guess it's going to be having less of that due to recent policy changes. And FedEx had that capability, and so that's important. But I do think that part of the deal where then they were putting FedEx drop boxes right in front of post offices and even inside of post offices, I don't see where that was a healthy thing for the Postal Service, where you're essentially bringing your competitor into your facility, for example. So I think that there are cases like this where this does become a relationship that is harmful to the Postal Service. And I think it's a good thing to have people who are mindful of this and are, you know, wary of these kinds of policy decisions that can have a negative influence that ultimately does begin to degrade the public service nature of the Postal Service, or perhaps even its long-range institutional health.
One of the criticisms of Amazon, and not necessarily the rate setting for Amazon products, but the relationship between the Postal Service and Amazon, was that Amazon was able to sort of learn how the Postal Service operated in delivering its products and then came to own shipping for its own products. In fact, it shifted the preponderance of Amazon products now delivered by Amazon itself rather than the Postal Service, and that shift started occurring maybe 5 years ago. Do you think that Amazon relationship with the Postal Service benefited the Postal Service and the public interest, or at the end of the day may have been unintended consequence of that relationship, what we have right now with the situation with the Postal Service?
Well, I think you put your finger on it with that one, where it definitely provided revenues that were very helpful in terms of just the basic budget to maintain postal operations. That's for sure. So there's certainly short-term benefits there. But in the longer term, I don't think Amazon has any particular commitment to being any kind of a partner with the Postal Service. And we can see that with the increasing number of Amazon delivery trucks out on streets making their deliveries. And so I think that those criticisms that have been made, there's a real basis in fact for that. So I do think that there are these kinds of consequences when you do have a arrangement such as the one that the Postal Service had with Amazon.
Let's shift gears a little bit. As you know, the Postal Service's ability to pay for its vast infrastructure, which is the foundation of the Universal Service Obligation, evaporated years ago. The failure to have the financial resources to meet expected operations has led to postage increases and service reductions, most recently the combination of slowing down the mail and raising prices. In your book, you suggest congressional appropriations to support postal operations and point to Amtrak as a good example of how that could occur. Could you explain?
Well, so I'm just looking for ways to ensure that we have the revenues to maintain universal service. And I think that this requires, you know, any possible solutions people have for this should be looked at and taken seriously. And one that seems sort of obvious is the idea of combining both the income from users, so postage revenues, with appropriation from the U.S. Treasury. and that is the way that Amtrak currently operates, where it does have the profitable trains that it runs between Boston and Washington, D.C., and then it has the trains that lose money, that are running through these sparsely populated areas of the West, for instance. And so that kind of situation where you have the profitable routes and the not profitable routes is also what the Postal Service has. And this also is an arrangement that has a precedent in history where the Post Office Department, although majority funded by sales of postage, did receive an appropriation most years, because most years it did not get enough postage revenues to offset its expenses. And so, you know, I think it's an idea that should be considered. And I know Stephen Kearney at the nonprofit Mailers has expressed interest in it. But I'm really pretty open to, you know, if someone has other ideas about how to do this, I definitely would be interested to consider those as well.
Yet there is a placeholder in current statute called the Public Service Appropriation, which is a subsidy that the Postal Service could ask for at any time. Of course, it's very minimal, that subsidy, and it's supposedly to provide support for universal service, but the Postal Service hasn't really asked for that money.
Yeah, and I do think that there has been some reticence amongst postal officials, because one thing, if they were to get an appropriation like that, is it would curtail their managerial autonomy, which is something that I think they're wary of.
But they sought money for COVID-19 assistance. And they sought money for electronic vehicles.
Right. It's true. There are exceptions that have been made. But these are, I guess, seen as temporary in nature, right? So they wouldn't perhaps change the long-term arrangement. Maybe that's why they're more attractive.
Final question. Chris, what do you think's in store for the Postal Service of the future?
I think that the Postal Service is not going to go away anytime soon, unlike how sometimes you hear discussions if that's going to happen. I think that the Postal Service has a lot of important roles that it will continue to play in American society, and I would hope that we think about what we want the Postal Service to be in the kind of expansive and creative way that our predecessors did in the 19th century and in the 20th century, and we can kind of think outside of it as just an agency to deliver letters. You know, things that we take for granted now, like the fact it delivers packages, you know, that was a new idea. The fact that it operated a savings bank was a new idea, and I think postal banking deserves another look. So my hope is that it will be an agency that continues to meet the needs of the American people and with a creative and expansive vision.
I want to thank Chris Schoff of the Center for Study of Responsive Law for joining me today. His new book, First Class, The United States Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat, can be purchased on the City Light Books website, Amazon.com, Target, or through your favorite bookseller. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you for having me on. Good talking to you.
Also, I want to thank NapsChat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy NapsChat, please leave a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store, and more importantly, share NapsChat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make me